Good morning. My name is Dick Kelsey. I represent the appellants in this case. This case, I think, may have overbriefed it. I apologize to the court if I did, but there are so many issues interrelated with one another, it was difficult not to do so. But I do think it boils down to two issues. We have two competing public policies here. Number one is that the process of producing a full and fair trial is part of the Due Process Clause. It's Rule 1 in the Rules of Civil Procedure. It is the underlying tenet of the Magna Carta. That is that you cannot render a judgment against someone if, in fact, they have not had a trial or there's been some trial procedure, either summary judgment or otherwise, unless they agree to that. There's no other way. Now, the second one is we have another procedure. We have another policy in this before all courts, and that is to have a judgment finalize things. And I think it's important to notice that we have a process at stake in one part of this case. We have an event at stake in the other part of the case. But the process should lead to the event. Now, the two issues, first of all, is was there a judgment made that at the time of the July 14th very informal procedure before the court? We argue there was not. We've submitted the authorities. We actually, I think the whole record's only 14 pages long, so that's at least a brief a boon to all of us not to have to read a long record. But the other aspect is then, when was that judgment made, and what was the content or proper content of the judgment that was supposedly announced verbally versus the judgment that got rendered and signed? I, frankly, have never understood or appreciated the finite distinction in those cases that say that if a judge announces a verbal judgment, that is a judgment of the court. But then we turn around and say, but the written document controls everything, controls the appellate issues, controls everything else. I've never been able to reconcile that in my mind, but I'll accept that for purposes of the argument. I'm obviously not going to change that at this point. Now, the second question before the court is who is bound by this judgment, if it is a judgment? First of all, the opposing side may argue that there was, in fact, a trial. There was no trial. There was no evidence produced of anything. What happened is that the Clarence and Onita, who are the parents, and their son Terry had originally filed a lawsuit for matters that involved control of a couple pieces of land. That ended up getting non-suited, and there was a counterclaim filed for declaratory judgment, counterclaim filed for temporary and permanent injunction. With the original petition being dismissed voluntarily, then obviously that puts them in the position of being the defendant in the case. Now, the facts are fairly simple. I'll run through them. And there was a subdivision of about 215 acres of land, a long, narrow subdivision. I think it's shown in the exhibits. We really tried to attach a lot of exhibits. It is so difficult when you're talking about land and positional situations in land. If you don't have the diagrams, it is very difficult to understand what's going on.
They're very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We worked hard to try to color code those and help the court in understanding what the issues were in the juxtaposition of the parties on the issue. That there was a long, narrow strip of land, and the only access was along the west side. It was subdivided and sold out mostly during Veterans Land Board transactions, among which are those in question. That there was a public road that came across 156, Farm Market Road 156, and went eastward, and that property where it eventually tied into the racetrack property. There was that public road was not documented. It was one of these undocumented just roads out there, which in north part of the county, I don't know about Tarrant County, but a lot of those are still out there, and they cause problems every time. Now, the Sports Authority needed, wanted a documented access to get from 156 to their property. And they did that through the power of condemnation. They condemned a six-acre tract. It's all shown in the diagrams. But they only improved the roadway for a small portion of that. They took the entire 6 acres. Now, it's important to the case to know who was involved in the condemnation. Only the owner of the six-acre tract was ever a party to the condemnation. So there was never any adjudication cutting off any of the other parties that accessed this 30-foot strip on the west side. So if you want to argue that somehow they acquired some right affecting non-litigated property, I think that's a false issue. That Terry's land actually abutted the 6 acres. And that becomes an issue because he wanted access to the publicly acquired property, which was publicly acquired for ingress and egress. And we all know the procedure that went on. The city then formed an authority, the authority condemned, and then the authority leased it for a long-term lease to the actual operators of the racetrack. So that's the procedure of the parties that are involved in the case. Sorry to take that much time, but it's kind of important. All right. Now, Terry's land is in the city limits of the city of Fort Worth, all of it. Only a portion of Clarence and Onita's land is in the city limits. Now, this becomes important because we have zoning questions, we have permitting questions for curb cuts, and permitting questions for signage. And that's an issue in the permanent injunction question. The Henrys had sued for non-interference with their property, basically, is what it amounts to. And then our position is on all of these municipal issues, on the zoning issue, on the curb cut issue, and on the signage issue, under the Sunnyvale case, those issues are not ripe. No one has, as I understand, that affects the jurisdiction of the court, trial court, or appellate court to render a decision if those type of issues are not ripe. So under the Sunnyvale case, we take the position that none of those issues are ripe and can't support any temporary injunction.
Which of the issues that you've raised, which issues do you think are not ripe yet? I mean,
The permanent injunction issues, which effectively say we can never have a sign and we can never get a curb cut. And our position is, and we've cited the authorities that say that is beyond the power of a court in temporary injunction issues. It's not ripe, but even at then, it's beyond the power of a court in temporary injunction issues because a court may not issue a temporary or a permanent injunction either way that says that if it's a permitting process, you can never go apply for the permit.
So that would be what I'm saying is in your issues presented portion of your brief, that would be number 11?
Yes, I believe that's correct. I can look at that and confirm, but I believe that's correct. I think it's one of the last issues which we presented, and we yes, it is. That's the correct number.
Thank you.
And I don't think we're going to have a big issue on that, but I'm prepared to answer any questions the court might have on that question. Now, what happened on July the 14th is that Mr. Trantham had withdrawn as the attorney for the plaintiffs back in April, and they had no attorney. But as part of the order of withdrawal, it had a resetting of the case for July the 14th. And that was the only notice ever issued to trial. The case came up on July the 14th that neither Clarence nor Onita were represented by counsel. They were not present in the court. The case was never called for appearances. No one made any appearances except voluntarily when Terry Henry appeared. And then the representatives for the now counterclaimants, now plaintiffs, all appeared through their attorneys of record. So I think it's critically important to note that Clarence and Onita Henry were not specifically notified of the trial other than the order of withdrawal. There is no certificate on file as required by Rule 10 for the withdrawing attorney to certify that the other party, that the party against whom they're withdrawing has been notified of all settings. That is simply not anywhere in this record, either in the transcript or in the statement of facts, to use old terminology. Now, what happened was that there was just talk on the record. Basically, the court said, okay, what do we have here? And then the party said, oh, well, you have an agreement. Now, this is the point where I am very sympathetic with the trial judge. I've never been a trial judge, so I wouldn't know, but I know the things happen. They've got a big docket locked, and they just want to get things done as quickly as possible and as efficiently as possible. That's fine, and I think that's entirely appropriate. But when it comes to issues that are going to be adjudicated, then the process and procedure becomes critically important. Because what happened is they asked Terry Henry, well, do you have your authority of your parents, that's Clarence and Onita, to enter into all of these things that are being discussed in front of the court? And he said yes. Okay. Now, we all know that, first of all, Rule 11 says that only a party must sign or the attorney can represent them on a Rule 11 agreement. There is no procedure in Rule 11 for a third party who has no duty to the court and no duty to a client to bind anyone else. Secondly, there is no evidence of an agency other than the declaration of the agent himself, which, as we all know from the cases I've cited, this court says will not sustain a finding of agency. So what ought the court to have done? The court ought to have said, look, you're presenting this as an agreement. There is an unsigned Rule 11, unsigned by anybody, not by the plaintiffs, not by the defendants, not by the counterclaimants, not by anybody. And it is then presented to the court as the agreement under Rule 11 to support the judgment. There is no evidence, and if Clarence and Onita Henry are in default status, then the case law says that there has to be a trial because they have an answer on file, and there is no trial. Try to find my recent Supreme Court case. I've cited that case, and there is a brand new recent Supreme Court case, which I've got back there, and I'm happy to give your – oh, we don't have clerks. I'll be happy to leave that citation. Fairly new Supreme Court case that says, again, if it is a no-answer default, you must present a prima facie case. And it said it again. It just reaffirmed what had been said before, and I'll give that citation to the court before I leave. So anyway, where we are is
you said I'm familiar with the case you just referred to, which sets the burden of proof required to render a default judgment. But you had made the comment that there was no trial, and I'm not sure that case supports the proposition that there was no trial in this case.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the distinction is there is a trial if the court calls for a trial and asks for witnesses and follows trial procedure. There was none of that in this case. And as a matter of fact, in the very small statement of facts that deals, court just calls everybody forward and says, what are we doing today? There is no attempt to try anything. There's no sworn testimony except that Terry Henry was sworn. And in responding to the questions from Mr. Burke, those statements would have been under oath for what they are worth. But no witnesses were sworn. No testimony was offered. It just simply doesn't meet the standards of a trial. And I don't think you have to if, in fact, you have a supportable Rule 11 agreement. Now, there's two kinds of supportable Rule 11 agreements. Your Honor, if I answered the question correctly, I'm not sure that I have.
If that's your answer, I mean, I accept it. Don't necessarily agree with it, but I do want to remind you, you do only have 2 minutes.
So the question is, in a Rule 11 agreement, that if it's not signed, and this was not, and if it's not dictated into the record in a fashion that the judge can say, I'm announcing this as my judgment, and nowhere in this record does the judge announce that this is his judgment. He says that'll be the order of the court, maybe judgment, maybe not. I urge the court to read the actual text of this very short record, and I know you probably have. We've cited it. We've cited the cases. We believe that this is a case that Clarence and Onita clearly cannot be bound by this judgment. And then we don't believe Terry is bound by the judgment for the reasons that he did not agree to the judgment, and he did not sign anything that satisfies Rule 11, and there was no trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelsey. Mr. Burt.
Thank you. It sounds almost like Mr. Kelsey wants to overturn two judgments. The one that was rendered in this case based on the party's agreement, and if he can get that one undone, the judgment that was rendered several years ago condemning the property, which the Fort Worth Sports Authority now leases to the Texas Motor Speedway. I believe the question squarely before you is, of the limited judicial resources available to residents of Denton County, how much more time should be devoted to this dispute? This case was set for trial. No one denies that they received notice of that trial setting. The parties negotiated a rather complex settlement agreement. The agreement was marked as an exhibit by me. It was filed in the clerk's record, so it would be easier to find. Mr. Henry, who said he was there on his own behalf, on behalf of his parents, testified at length that he understood the agreement and it was the agreement of the parties. After receiving the parties' agreement, the trial judge
put on the witness stand and sworn in as a witness?
It was all done right in front of the judge. He was sworn, yes, ma'am.
Okay.
But he was not put in the witness stand.
Okay.
The court, after hearing this testimony and the evidence and receiving the written agreement into the record, said, I render your agreement as an order of the court this day. Those were the final words of the trial judge. If you look at the samples exterminating case cited by both parties and compare what the trial court said in that case, which is, it appearing to the court that all of you did agree in open court to this settlement, the court approves the settlement made in open court and orders all parties to sign any and all papers to carry out this settlement and to carry out the agreement that was made and dictated into the record. That's what the trial court said in the samples case. It's a 1982 Supreme Court case. The Supreme Court says of that particular language, in the instant case, after the parties voiced their approval of the settlement, dictated in open court, the trial court rendered judgment by ordering them to follow and sign the agreement. That is precisely what happened in this case.
Except that we had some parties who were not there, and you're relying on Mr. Henry being the agent of the parties who were not present.
I agree there are two questions.
Yeah.
Whether or not Terry Henry is bound, which I think is on all fours with the samples case, and whether or not his parents were bound. And I think you're correct. In order to answer the second question, whether or not the parents were bound, you have to look at the rules regarding evidence of agency. And I think you look not only to the testimony, but I think you can also look to the conduct of the parties. And one of the cases cited by Mr. Kelsey, I believe it Norse Brothers versus Mattson. It talks about agency may not be established by the testimony of the agent alone, but then it goes on to talk about the particular circumstance before this court, which is where the master, Onetta and Clarence, the parents in this case, do not testify as to the relationship of the alleged servant or agent, slight testimony will be accepted to raise the presumption of agency. And I think, in addition to slight testimony, conduct also can support the finding of agency, which was made by Judge Shipman in this case. There was a notice of a trial setting. It was the day for the determination of the issues in this case. Their son showed up. They did not show up. They did not send an attorney. They knew their attorney had withdrawn. And he says, I'm here for me and I'm here for my parents. I think those circumstances in combination with his testimony are evidence sufficient to support the finding of agency made by Judge Shipman. I would also like to raise a question that I have regarding the authorities relied on by Mr. Kelsey with regard to agency, and that is this. Those cases almost uniformly deal with facts where the agent is testifying about things he said outside of court. In other words, I said to the plaintiffs or I said to other people that I represent the alleged principal. In this case, we're not talking about out-of-court hearsay statements. We're talking about someone showing up and testifying affirmatively under oath that I am the agent for my parents. Most of those cases, although the language of the holding would say that statements of the agent cannot support agency, the facts underlying those cases are we're talking about hearsay statements, and that's not the case here. Here we have someone appearing on the day of trial and testifying affirmatively that I am the agent, and I think that's distinguishable from the facts in, I believe, all of the cases cited by Mr. Kelsey and by myself. It's just a unique circumstance.
But how do you get around the Rule 11 requirement of either the person has to sign the agreement or their attorney has to sign the agreement or do so in open court?
They have to agree in open court, the parties or their attorney. And it doesn't limit the parties to their actual presence. It doesn't say it has to be you. It doesn't limit it to appearance by agents. It's an unusual circumstance. I haven't found any cases which deal with a non-attorney showing up for other folks, certainly not parents. But I think it's one of those circumstances where I would appeal to common sense.
But doesn't that create a situation that basically allows a layperson individual to represent another layperson, which generally is considered to be the practice of law?
I think if the Henrys believe that their son engaged in an unauthorized practice of law, they ought to report that. And if they don't think that their son had authority to act on their behalf at this trial, they ought to have filed something with the court saying that affirmatively, and they have not.
Well, It appears to be a little bit more liberal than I think most of us understand it in typical situations to be. It says, unless otherwise provided in these rules, no agreement between attorneys or parties, which I read to mean it could be an agreement between parties, touching any suit, etc. And so Mr. Henry would be there on behalf of himself and the other two parties, and then the other parties would be represented by counsel, so it would be agreement between parties, essentially.
I agree.
That's a plausible construction of the rule.
In fact, you could have a circumstance where the parties went around the attorneys and entered into a written agreement or showed up at court. And it could be an enforceable Rule 11 agreement. I think you're correct. Much of what Mr. Kelsey has touched on in his argument deals with what happens if the court did not render judgment. And I think you just don't get past that in this case. On the day that the case was called for trial, the parties appeared, entered into an agreement, and he said, I render it as an order of the court this day. If that is a rendition, which I think it plainly is, nothing that follows in his argument makes any sense or matters. On page, I think it's 12 of his brief, he states that the agreement became verbatim the judgment. He raises some issues in his brief that the judgment is maybe or inconsistent with the agreement. That's not even consistent with the heart of his brief. Here the parties' agreement was entered in record in keeping with the rationale underlying Rule 11, which is that we don't want people entering into an agreement orally that we can't accurately know what they were. in Birdwell versus Cox in 1857, the Supreme Court articulated the rationale behind Rule 11, which is we want to make sure that there's not confusion about oral agreements. In this case, Mr. Kelsey is encouraging this court to ignore the written agreement, which the parties said was their agreement, which was filed of record, and look solely to just what they said on the record and said to the court reporter. That not only ignores the literal words of Rule 11, it ignores the rationale underlying Rule 11.
But how can you get around doing that? Because the Rule 11 agreement wasn't signed.
It was entered in record. It was made of record. And so you don't have to sign it if it's of record.
Right, but I'm just saying you can't get around the agreement. You're saying the agreement of the parties, but really the agreement of the parties is bootstrapped onto the authority of Terry to represent his parents or to agree for his parents, because really there's no evidence that the parents agreed to anything other than if Terry represented them and had the authority to agree for them.
As to Onetta and Clarence, that's
right.
True. You're right. If he didn't have authority to enter into this Rule 11 agreement, if there weren't sufficient authority or evidence of authority, then yes, the judgment as to his parents can't be sustained, and you shouldn't do so. But that doesn't mean that the judgment shouldn't be sustained as to Terry Henry and remanded to the trial court as to his parents. I think that's a tough call that y'all have to make. I think the common sense and the established rules of evidence on agency support our position, but certainly there are policy considerations.
And the notice that you're saying that the parents received is actual notice through the notation in the order allowing their attorney to withdraw.
Yes, ma'am. Pursuant to Rule 10, the attorney withdrawing is obligated to provide a copy of that order and notice of all settings to them. And Mr. Kelsey cites many cases which say that there has to be evidence in the record of notice. All of those cases involve a circumstance where the person appealing says, I didn't get notice. These people haven't said they didn't get notice. They just say there's no evidence of notice in the record. In order to trigger that analysis, you've got to say, I didn't know. They didn't say to the trial court, I didn't know about the trial setting, and they haven't said to you all that they didn't know about the trial setting. They're just saying, as a technical point, there wasn't sufficient evidence in the record. They got to jump through the first hoop. They got to say, I didn't know, and they did.
You know, it's interesting because in a way the argument of apparent authority puts the trial judge in the position of being a fact witness, in the sense that the apparent authority that's being demonstrated is to the judge, and it's the judge is making the determination whether or not Mr. Henry actually has the authority to represent his parents in this proceeding or not. Okay, and now I realize there's the other dimension is with regard to the agreement between the parties, but just a thought I had.
I don't think he's a fact witness. I think he is the trier of fact, and this case, in fact, was set for trial before him. It wasn't set for a jury trial, so I don't think it changes his position vis-a-vis what he would have been deciding at the trial.
Your theory would be that the apparent authority would be as between the parties and the court, recognizing the apparent authority is just making a finding of fact in his own mind as to whether or not this agreement is a binding agreement on the other parties who didn't show up.
Correct. In other words, he's...
Purpose of the judgment, yeah. Okay.
Sorry to interrupt. He's observing what he knows about the record. He's observing the relationship of the parties as testified by Mr. Henry, and he's observing his demeanor in saying that he has their authority. He's observing, the demeanor of the parties and the circumstances under which the agreement's being announced, which in this case was the trial setting.
I didn't get a chance to look at the record in this case, is there any anything submitted post judgment by the Henrys, in form such as an affidavit stating we didn't give our son this authority, etc.?
I don't believe there's any affidavits, and I don't believe that any of their motions were verified, but I may be incorrect that Mr. Kelsey may have verified some motion in compliance with the rule, but there's no affidavit or testimonial evidence that their son didn't have authority. There's no affidavit or testimonial evidence that they didn't know about the trial setting.
Okay.
Do y'all have any other questions?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions regarding your position that the agreement was, or the judgment was rendered actually on the 14th of that month. Why does the judge then continue, let's see, he says, how long before we get the final judgment in? And then the court later on page 13 of the reporter's record, everything needs to be finalized, signed, and your parents signed off. It says if all the dates are missed for some reason and it is not all finished within this 30-day period, then you would be back here and I will decide what went wrong and what we're going to do from there. And it, and then at the bottom of page 14, at the end of the hearing, he just says, I'll approve the agreement and render it as an order of this court today. How does that get you to a judgment that day?
At the very end, he makes the agreement an order of the court, and that's a rendition per samples. The other discussion that precedes that, I believe, is a practical discussion. The entry of the judgment could have taken... you can follow this agreement and put that into words, written words, in several different ways. You could have attached exhibits that were signed. You could have done what we did, make all of the particular agreements, orders of the court, and declarations, and attach exhibits. And I think that just reflects the reality that even once you render judgment, the written words of the judgment can take many different forms. There's not a precise way to render that's – you can obviously – the judgment can be outside of the agreement, but that's not the case here.
But if a judgment requires future acts, how can it be a final judgment? I mean, what the court ordered required future acts, even gave them a specific time period to perform those acts.
The acts of the parties were in the future. The act of the court in approving and ordering it was present, and that's all that's required for rendition. Present intent that the judge make a final decision, which he did in adopting the settlement agreement of the parties. The fact that the parties had to do something else in the future doesn't affect the finality of the rendition.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Burke. Mr. Kelsey.
Let me try to respond to what I've noted during the argument. Counsel said conduct somehow can ratify agency. We have no example of conduct. There's nothing in the record. He gives no example of conduct. They simply were not there. And the court also, I think it's very important in the last few questions to look at exactly what was agreed upon, because if you actually read the text of what was agreed upon, it was agreed to sign the order, sign the settlement agreement. That was what was done. There's no statement anywhere in this record that the very first part of it is that these people are going to agree to sign. Now, the Songer case, which we've extensively briefed, says a court cannot enforce an agreement to sign without a completely separate contractual proceeding.
Is there any evidence in the record controverting the son's testimony that he represents his parents?
There is none, Your Honor. I mentioned that in my brief, and the answer is it's not in the record, so I'm not going to cite it to the court.
Okay.
And
but there were post-judgment motions filed, correct? No?
I do not believe there were. There was no motion for reconsideration, no motion for new trial.
So that you're challenging apparent authority for the first time on appeal from, was there any evidence that there was no notice of the judgment given?
No, we received notice of the final judgment.
Okay, so you didn't bring this to the court's attention in the trial court, and you're raising this issue of challenging apparent authority for the first time on appeal.
Your Honor, I cannot answer that question with going outside the record. I'm happy to answer it, but if you'd like me to, I will, but it'll require
me to go outside the record. Well, I'm just asking you, is that what the record reflects?
That's what the record reflects.
Okay.
But I cannot respond truthfully to your question without going outside the record.
Well, is what you just said not truthful?
Well, in full answer to your question, let me put it that way. All right, Your Honor, the agreement is the judgment was to approve the agreement, not to make a judgment of the court. This is a critical distinction because, as Justice Livingston has pointed out time and time again, Justice Walker as well, that's what the record actually reads. It's only 14 pages. It's very simple. And let me look at the final judgment. The final judgment actually says the court rendered a post-answer default judgment against the parents. And I did find my case. I had it over there. I apologize. And I'll give you the quick cite on that if you'd like it. It's Dolgen Corp, Dolgencorp. And it's reported in 288 Southwest 3rd, 922, Texas Supreme Court case, reported in the September 15th advance sheet. I will briefly read that. But if the defendant files an answer, a trial court may not render judgment on the pleadings, and the plaintiff is required to offer evidence and prove all aspects of its claim, end quote. No attempt to do that whatsoever in this case. Now, one other thing is the agreement of the parties contained a form of final judgment. The final judgment they are seeking the court to sign and did get the court to sign is not the judgment that was attached to the agreement. They are completely separate. So what if the point is they agreed to what was in the agreement, which is unsigned, then they have to sign the judgment that's contained in the agreement. That is not, in fact, what occurred. And said on page 7, line 19, and there is a agreed final judgment granting the permanent injunction that is the last document that is a part of this settlement. Do you see that? So the judgment that got signed by the court has the roundabout effect of not only enforcing an unsigned agreement, but making that unsigned agreement the judgment of the court without ever announcing that that's exactly what happened. So I'm in sympathy with the trial judge. I understand how this case got there. If I'd been a trial judge, I might have done exactly the same thing. The point is the law does not allow this judgment to stand. I'll be happy to answer any questions the court may have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kelsey. Mr. Burke, the court appreciates your appearance here this morning, presents your arguments. We'll take a 5-minute recess, at which time we'll return and call the 10:30 case. Thank you.